Scaffold is supported by the Architecture Foundation, bringing new voices to the conversation about architecture in London and around the world. For more information and upcoming events, visit architecturefoundation.org.uk. When I first moved to London almost a decade ago, having just finished architecture school, I remember scouring the city for events, lectures, and exhibitions, really looking for some kind of scene that might bring me closer to new people and new thinking about architecture. And what grabbed my attention almost immediately was this new debate series called Turncoats. Supported by none other than the Architecture Foundation, Turncoats was irreverent and iconoclastic, tackling fundamental issues facing contemporary practice. The first debate, held in 2015, had the provocative title Quit Architecture Now, and featured a group of panelists who'd all successfully escaped the profession. Other debates focused on such topics as the farce that's been made of community consultation, the narrow constraints of designing for nuclear families, the cultural elitism inherent to minimalist aesthetics, and the corporatization of feminism. Being there, you really felt this collective animus for the status quo, a lament at the state of affairs in architecture, but also, crucially, this glimmering optimism for what might still be possible. One of the key instigators of this Turncoat series was my guest this week, Finn Harper, and all the ingredients of that series, the spectacle of debate, the questioning of orthodoxy, even this enthusiasm for designing symbols to represent social movements, they're all present in much of Harper's other work. Finn, who uses they-them pronouns, is a regular contributor to The Guardian with a career that spans criticism, curation, education, youth engagement, journalism, and even sculpture. They began their career as an assistant editor at the Architectural Review, where they became deputy editor before joining the Architecture Foundation in 2015 as deputy director, alongside Ellis Woodman. While at the AF, in addition to the Turncoat series, Finn established the new Architecture Writers Program, alongside Tom Wilkinson, which is this highly successful, ongoing, free program for young design critics of color. And they also initiated the AF's Young Trustees Group, creating a position of influence in the industry for younger architects. Among many other things, Finn was also co-curator of the 2019 Oslo Architecture Triennial, and most recently has served as chief executive of Open City, an educational charity best known for its annual Open House Festival. And it was a position they held from early 2020 until just last month. We recorded our conversation back in December 2023, prior to Finn's departure from Open City, at their flat in Greenwich's Vanbrugh Park estate. In our conversation, we focus a lot on Finn's personal influences, and also on their reflections on the state of architectural criticism and practice. But what we didn't address in much detail was their sculptural work, these delicate, cascading, often technicolor mobiles, which are actually being exhibited right now in South London at San Mai Gallery until the 1st of June, which you might want to check out. I've put a link to it in the show notes. All right, so here's my interview from December 2023 with the polymath sculptor, critic, and architectural impresario, Finn Harper. I hope you enjoy it. I thought as a way of starting, we could begin with this topic of education. I mean, you've spoken elsewhere about the fact that you were homeschooled. And I'm curious to know how your parents taught you.
My parents were both trained as teachers, secondary school teachers. And I think they were lucky in a sense that they started out teaching in Britain when teaching was kind of ascendant, like it was this noble calling, there was a decent amount of money, local authorities still owned and ran schools in a way that they really don't very much anymore. And they were quite optimistic about the teaching profession. But even then, they could see, and they were very frustrated by, the problems that were within the kind of state school system. And I think they just wanted to have a crack at doing it themselves. Like, what would it be like to educate young people without the constraints that come with an institution? And so when they had kids, I think it was like quite an easy decision for them to be like, oh, well, you know, maybe we could try home educating. And they had enough disposable time to make that a reality. So my mum would teach us during the day in the weekdays, and then she'd write in the evening or do other sorts of work in the evening. And then my dad would teach us at the weekends, and he would teach at a secondary school during the week, which might sound like we were sort of just like continuously in education, but like the reality of home ed is actually that there is a very blurry line between what is and isn't learning, and it's quite light touch, or it was for us. And so, especially like when I was little, you could probably do as much as your peers were doing in school in an hour. Like they would take a day, we would take an hour, and like just bash through this stuff, because schools can be so slow and inefficient. You don't necessarily have to learn in these kind of subjects like people do at school, you know. We would structure our education around projects rather than subjects. So you might do a project on the Tudors, mm-hmm. and that would involve costume, it would involve food, it would involve obviously history and art, but you'd sort of wrap all of these subjects into a project. We did another one on eggs because mum wanted to get chickens. And so it was a completely different way of like compartmentalizing an education compared to, you know, schools where it's all kind of quite systematized by these disciplines.
Mm-hmm. I'm curious what you thought of people in school, or what that world meant to you, what the world of institutions meant to you when you were outside of it.
Well, I'm still very skeptical of institutions and institutionalization, and like there's obviously good schools and better schools and worse schools and so on, but like actually a lot of the children I'd meet home educated were people who had tried school, and it was so alienating and they were bullied so brutally that they had to pull out. You know, I'm very persuaded by the argument that schools they're kind of like factories, like the way that the day is structured, the way that the learning is compartmentalized, the way that children are kind of processed in these batches. And I'm not really convinced at all that that is the best environment to learn stuff, but it's also possibly not the best environment to learn how to be a human and how to socialize and how to sort of be confident in the world. So there are home educated people who, you know, maybe struggle to like interact with the wider world. It depends a lot on like your parents and their outlook, and I don't think our I don't think our home educated experience was perfect by any stretch, but I strongly contest the idea that schools are like fine. I think schools have deep, deep flaws as well. And that's not to say that teachers are bad or that schools are bad, but like we should be able to describe the flaws of the school system as well as their strengths.
You mentioned your mother would write in the evenings or on the weekends. What was she writing?
She did some children's fiction. Christian publisher called Lion kind of cottoned onto her. And she did a whole series called My Mum and Other Horror Stories, which was basically like loosely rearranged stories from our life. And then there was various other stories. She did a kind of reworking of the Pied Piper myth, where it's sort of like, well, what happens next? You know, once the Pied Piper has taken all these children into the mountain, where did they go? And like, what happened to them after that?
I love that to her, fables became malleable, it sounds like, especially with this Pied Piper example, that you can take these seemingly kind of calcified stories and manipulate them.
I think there's something about Christianity in that, because like both my parents are Christian. My mum would probably describe herself more as a Quaker now, but you're constantly looking at these parables from the Old Testament and the New Testament, and you're trying to make sense of them, and you kind of have to reinterpret them. Like you can't just be like, oh, you know, take the log from your eye before you, but like a literal log was it? So in both bringing up in a kind of bringing up children in a Christian tradition and then preaching at church, I think finding the stories that everyone knows and loves from the Bible and then like recasting them in a modern way, or like putting a different spin on them to the maybe traditional spin, was like quite a regular routine, you know. It was like part of the week was re-understanding Jonah or something. And so I can see how that then like bled into her writing tradition of like enjoying finding fairy tales and parables and like representing them in a different light.
I have it on good authority that you would also be speaking at the church occasionally, that you, there is a kind of early education in oratory possibly through your religious upbringing.
Yeah, I don't go to church currently, but you know, we did every Sunday for most of my childhood, and we went to a church that their shtick was that there is no one preacher, it's a sort of shared endeavour that the congregation take it in turns, both to lead the service and then to lead the sermon. And that was probably quite a creative space within the kind of spectrum of what kind of church you go to. And there was not everybody in the church was good at it, but like lots of the people who had a go would try to bring some sort of flair to the way that they led a church service. So I guess from an early age, there were these regular opportunities to not just like be on stage. You know, you weren't just like dancing or performing for its own right, but like trying to find a way of conveying some kind of lesson within a fun format. And then, you know, as you get older, they start to invite you to do more serious stuff. And you actually end up preaching about when I lived in Nigeria, and that went down very badly. And I sort of criticised the whole Christian approach to, well, this particular church's approach to Islam. And some of the older congregation were really enthusiastic and they loved it. And then some of the younger, you know, the middle-aged people were very sceptical. I think I was probably banned from preaching after that. My mom was banned from preaching because she did a sermon called something like Seven Annoying Women from the Bible. And she just went, there's not that many women in the Bible. And she went through these seven archetypes like Ruth and, you know, Mary and sort of described what she found annoying about them and how she struggled as a woman to identify with any of the women in the Bible because they all seemed such either flakes or like they wouldn't stand up for themselves. And it was, I think it was a sincere attempt to find feminist teaching in the Bible. Framed in a kind of deliberately provocative and fun way, but some of the more sober members of the congregation just thought she was being cantankerous.
Hmm. And those two examples, it sounds like there is an education in testing the boundaries or pushing back against orthodoxy.
Yeah.
There's a kind of, again, flexibility to these systems that we often take as given,
yeah,
or received wisdom. When you imagine someone who grew up in a religious household or who had a religious upbringing, you think of it as a passive reception of social mores and values and probably a certain degree of conservatism.
Mm-hmm.
But the way you're describing it, it seems almost the opposite.
I think it's part of a kind of activist tradition to constantly like question the world and needle it. And that is partly because you're trying to learn about it, figure it out. But it's also because if something is stupid, like probably it ought to change, and it won't change unless people question it and confront it and present alternatives. So it's a way of making, I think, progress happen is to be skeptical of received wisdom in general.
Are you still religious? This is a surprise. I don't think I've ever asked anyone these kinds of questions before, but they seem somehow central.
I don't know if they're central. It's just like you just started asking me about church. yeah, to some extent. Like, I don't have a lot of faith in institutions and even Quakers, which is like, you know, really nice, friendly people at Quakers, even Quakers I found a bit disappointing recently, in their kind of timidity around certain political issues. And so at the moment I'm not getting very much from organised faith.
I think the reason I'm asking these questions is because, despite maybe your more recent disenchantment, there's always been this draw to alternative social structures, it seems. And it begins probably with this group called the Woodcraft Folk. Could you tell me more about who they are and your relationship to them?
Yeah, Woodcraft Folk are a charity that started in the 1920s in this kind of burst of optimistic youth movements that were set up after the First World War all over Europe. And I think what was going on was a lot of Europeans were just like horrified by what had happened in World War One, and were trying to build a better future. They were trying to say, like, let's not let that happen again. We need to sort of educate young people in very different ways to create a more positive future. And so there's this kind of utopian moment where all these youth movements are bursting out. And Woodcraft Folk is explicitly a British socialist youth movement that at the very start is set up by teenagers with the mission of taking young people who are basically working class inner city kids and then going out and camping in the wilderness, creating a kind of a micro community for a week or two, learning to sort of like key survival nature type skills, but also imbuing that with a really kind of strong political idea that like the way the world is like produced by capitalism, and under socialism it could be different or better. And although, you know, your power as a young person is hugely constrained by going into the forest and making a camp, you can start to test out ideas of like what that socialist society could be more like. I've written a book about, or like, you know, edited a book about Woodcraft Folk. It played a huge role in my life up until sort of 20, you know, 24 or something.
In the introduction to that book, you've written that adults often frame the limits of their children's ambitions. And I think this generational tension, this perceived conflict between younger and older generations, seems to run through a lot of the work you do now. Before we start to trace that topic through your more recent work, sure, I just want to stay with the Woodcraft experience for a bit. Because it seemed like it was an environment where you were really able to flourish as a young person and to find a sense of autonomy within a community. You became the founding editor of the newsletter that they publish?
Well, yeah, they'd had lots of different newspapers throughout the, you know, the decades, but there was an opportunity to make a new newspaper, and I thought that sounded a lot of fun, and had a go at it. And in a way, I don't think I'd have ever got into working at the Architecture Review, which was this sort of key pivot in my career away from architectural practice and into kind of curation and journalism. I don't think I'd have got that job if I hadn't had this like quite substantial body of editorial work from working on this charity's internal membership newsletter.
So this was really your first encounter with media, with working in media.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, yeah, I think you and I grew up at a time where like computers were just, they weren't, I guess we experienced the change from computers being like quite a rare thing to a absolute necessity. And so I was playing with media as it was being kind of invented and rolled out to consumers throughout my childhood.
And so why architecture?
Well, yeah, I studied architecture because I didn't really know what to study, and architecture seemed to be a combination of stuff, you know.
But it seems like equally you could have gone into a career in journalism or politics. that would have hewn quite closely to the enthusiasm you felt around this experience of holding some kind of sway or influence or affecting social change through text.
The politicians and the journalists, you know, proper journalists and proper politicians that I know, I think have quite limited lives. Like they there's only a few sorts of types of thing that they get to do. Whereas architecture is like, you make art, you make objects, you like think about mechanics and engineering and material science, as well as doing all of the kind of communication and politics and history stuff. So it felt, as a, you know, whatever, 17-year-old thinking about what university course to do, like a much more expansive opportunity, almost as a way of like having your cake and eating it. You sort of do a bit of everything by studying architecture.
And when you went into architecture school, did you have the ambition to practice, or did you know from the beginning that this was going to be a segue into something else?
No, I probably thought I was on the sort of pipeline to being an architect like everyone else.
Mm-hmm. And when did that change?
It took a bit for the 2008 recession to kind of hit the built environment, but it really hit architectural practices when I graduated. So I was struggling to get a job as a part one, had made a sort of stupid commitment to not getting a job in London. So I was trying to get a job in Edinburgh and then Newcastle.
And why were you committed to that?
It seemed like everyone was going to London. That seemed like the boring, obvious thing to do, go and work like a, you know, big practice, Alison Morrison or whatever in London. So I guess I very naively, again, don't know any architects, thought that it might be an interesting counterpoint to go somewhere else. But of course, there's even fewer jobs going in Newcastle than London at that time. So I was kind of casting around for a bit. I was on Job Seeker's Allowance, living with my dad, and saw a job come up at the Architectural Review for an editorial assistant. And I was like, well, it's not architecture, but like that could be fun. And I've done kind of media stuff before. Didn't think of myself as a writer, but did think, you know, I could probably be an editorial assistant. And so went for it, and much to my surprise, got it. But it was Kath Slessor was the editor then, and Will Hunter was the deputy editor of the AR. And so maybe they quite liked that they hadn't heard of me, like, who's this person from Wales? Where's Wales? that I wasn't one of the kind of obvious suspects that they could have hired. But yeah, got that job. Turned out I was quite good at being an editorial assistant. I feel like quite quickly made an impact on the magazine. Ended up getting promoted a few times to the point of being deputy editor within 4 years, 4.5 years or something. So it was a huge kind of turning point to go from literally being on the dole to being at the Architectural Review.
So did it become kind of settled then that this kind of work, this work that's adjacent to practice but about architecture, that orbits architecture but is not in the business of producing architecture itself, was for you, or did you still have ideas of entering the discipline?
I got a sense that like it was sort of too late for me to enter the discipline. I was like, if I'd wanted to go back and do part, I actually started part two, and then there's a part-time course at the WSA, Welsh School of Architecture, and abandoned ship and just sort of got really stuck into the AR. I felt like I'd sort of missed that opportunity, and I still sort of feel like that, and that's maybe why I started sculpting, you know, making these kind of funny little mobiles is as a way to flex a kind of design impulse or a kind of making impulse that I don't get from writing or running an organization so much. And in fact, if you look at my work at the Architecture Foundation and at Open City, I'm like probably spending far too much time as a chief executive, like making socks, creating little designed objects. Because I do fundamentally love design and like material production and object culture.
Which began in a way with the woodcraft folk. Like there are images in the book you edited of staffs that you'd carved.
Yeah, they were in the bedroom.
And t-shirts that you'd silkscreen printed on. There's a lot of these kind of objects that symbolize one's affinity to a relationship with a community or a kind of tribe.
Yeah.
That seem to persist through your more recent work. So you're talking about the Architecture Foundation, and there was a lot of great merch. That was put out during your tenure there.
Yeah. So why merch? I think that there is... I maybe this comes from like growing up in this organization, Woodcraft Folk, or even the church, like an understanding that symbols are a powerful binder for movements, you know, social movements, and that it's social movements that achieve change. And you don't necessarily need the symbol, but it like really helps to kind of glue a set of people together around a set of values or some sort of shared mission if they have some iconography that they share. And so for Woodcraft Folk, they have all these emblems of like trees and sunsets. For the church, they have like the lamb, the cross, whatever, halos, like all of these kind of icons. And I was maybe a bit surprised actually that like the design world, despite being full of phenomenally creative people, doesn't have very, you know, the sort of stupid cliches are like, you know, the French blue worker's jacket or maybe the black roll neck turtleneck jumper, or maybe like a certain kind of sophisticated glasses. But like we don't, as architects, have so many kind of internal social movements and like corresponding symbols or folk symbols. And so when we were setting up, rebooting Architecture Foundation, me and Ellis Woodman, for a while we were like trying to make some symbols that could help to do that. And the Architecture Foundation logo was really boring at the time. It was just the words, the Architecture Foundation, in a quite dreary font. So I think Ellis first invented a program called Carte Blanche, which was going to be a sort of roaming set of panel discussions. And he commissioned a kind of totem, like a wooden totem, and a font to go with this program. And that was maybe the first attempt, but like over the years, we did that trick again and again, like the papers, this day-long festival of the refugee crisis at Calais and the kind of culture that's coming out of that camp had its own emblem, had its own sort of graphic style. Turncoats, this series of sort of incendiary, off-the-record debates, had its own emblem and like objects that went with it. When we started New Architecture Writers, that had again like its own symbol, own badges, had its own website. And it wasn't like we were trying to undermine the main Architecture Foundation brand, but it was like we were trying to seed these different kind of subcultures that might become something unto themselves at some point in the future. And to some extent we succeeded, like turncoats, people started doing them around the world. Like they spread out and they used the same symbols and formats, but like in a completely different cultural context. New Architecture Writers kind of developed its own momentum, is now, you know, quite celebrated as a kind of positive thing for black and brown people working in as aspiring design journalists. I think the one I'm most proud of is maybe the Young Trustees, the Architecture Foundation Young Trustees, which is this like semi-autonomous group of self-renewing young people who are not legally trustees of the Architecture Foundation, but are imbued with a little bit of power, I think a small budget and a bit of a platform to instigate stuff. And initially, it was quite a slow burn and they took a lot of staff support, but now it really feels like they are a vital part of the Architecture Foundation overall ecosystem, and that they drive forward often sort of difficult conversations pretty much autonomously. And I think that was, again, like trying to kind of create something with its own identity that could then pay dividends into the future and create a sort of social group for young people in the industry in London to organize around and then to achieve projects through.
And to me, it also engenders this tension across generations that you seem quite drawn to and have been for quite some time.
Yeah, well, that all stems from Woodcraft Folk, because Woodcraft Folk is like this charity that has the lowest average age of any board of trustees in the UK, and also often the youngest trustee. Like, they will often be like, they will have the youngest young person on any board, as well as the youngest average age. And it also has all these subcommittees of young people who are then able to like self-organize and self-advocate. And so I've always had this strong sense that having meaningful opportunities for young people to wield power within an institution is not only totally fine, but really productive.
You gave this lecture in 2018 at the British School in Rome called "The Kids Aren't All Right." And it was all about generational change. You were asked to give the audience an image of the millennial architect and kind of a digest or understanding of the millennial condition, as it were.
Yeah.
And in a short span of time now, to be a millennial means something entirely different than it did when you were up at that podium. At that time, you were the young person that an older generation were looking to for, I think, a certain kind of wisdom that comes with youth and inexperience, or the kind of the benefits of a certain ambition that is fueled by, to some extent, naivete, necessarily. Mm-hmm. But now...
Now I'm old.
Yeah, now you're old. I say this because I'm right beside you on this. I feel so old now. I mean, I'm a little bit older than you, I think. How old are you?
I'm 35.
35, okay, I'm 36. And I feel like my relationship to young people, to kids these days, is changing.
Sure.
And it has in quite a short span of time, where it's becoming more difficult to understand. And so I wonder what your experience of aging has been like.
So, well, so far, it gets better every year. You know, like, I feel happier now than I ever have done. And I obviously understand the stress of aging as well. But, like, broadly, I feel like I get more calm and sensible, but also, like, more able to pursue things that I'm interested in, and more content as I get older. But I don't really think like that much has changed, in a sense that I still think young people are broadly disempowered by society. I still think the architecture industry like has a crap relationship with young people and the way that it exploits young people. And so even though I am older, I don't know if that means very much. Like, I still think we should, as an industry, be finding better vehicles to support young people to have a voice, and not just have a voice, but like to be heard, and for them to be able to affect change.
I think in the work you have been doing over the past decade, it always seems to anticipate the momentum burgeoning in a younger generation. And I mean, especially with this new architecture writers program, which preceded, of course, George Floyd and this kind of massive shift in the industry of architecture's perception of inequity, racial inequity. So there's this kind of avant-garde quality to that project in a way.
Yeah.
Within the context of architectural practice in the UK, let's say.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And the industry of architectural criticism. But then also in your aesthetic, if we could call it that. And I want to talk a bit about this relationship between aesthetics, and especially your personal aesthetics, and politics. I'm talking specifically about clothing.
Oh, yeah.
And self-presentation, and the way one forms a persona or public identity.
Yeah.
In your case, not only through color and vibrancy, but also through skirts or dresses. This is something that's become a common piece in your ensemble. You're known as the person that wears the skirts. And it's not actually the man who wears the skirts. It's the gender-neutral person that wears the skirt.
Well, men should wear more skirts too. I think that skirts are a fantastic garment, and I'm always surprised how few men would even consider wearing, like, a lot of them, like, oh, I only wear a skirt occasionally or special occasions or when I'm in the mood. It's like, no, absolutely never. And that feels really weird to me, especially in like a society that otherwise has made enormous strides at dismantling the hard division between what is a man's role and a woman's role. You'd be like, sort of laughed out of town if you sort of said something like, oh, well, men shouldn't really have a role in child caring, or women shouldn't really be in the boardroom. Like, those are both completely absurd suggestions, at least for our culture in London kind of design world. But men wearing skirts is still like a serious taboo. And I think that is silly. And I also think that it is ultimately detrimental to like progress towards gender equity that we like maintain these taboos. And so I started wearing skirts 6 years ago at the urging of my sister, kind of to like see if she had a point that like more men should wear skirts or more non-women should wear skirts, and haven't really looked back. Like, it's fantastic. Skirts are they're hugely practical, they're quite expressive, they come in like just a phenomenally wide range of styles and materials that I don't see in most menswear departments. I don't actually think my aesthetic is particularly playful or youthful. I just think most other people's is like really constrained, like really, really dull. And I think that's true of like how I dress, but also like the kind of graphic design I'm drawn to, or the kind of architecture that I'm drawn to. Is I don't think it's trying to be silly. I just think there's a lot of stuff that's trying to be very serious and very sober. And I'm not convinced that that is the best way to spend your life, trying to be serious and sober. I think we should allow ourselves to have a bit more fun and a bit more colour in our lives, without feeling like we're channeling our inner child or something.
When I was kind of grasping for the segue into the skirt topic earlier.
Sure.
I don't think I quite landed it.
Okay, sorry. Well, no, delete that section.
No, but it's more... I think that your attunement to youth, as it's continuously redefined, to the culture of youth, the ambitions of youth, the worldviews of younger people, to me, also marks this awareness of what we might think of as the bondage of the present. I'm always curious about whatever habits or mores or attitudes I hold now that will in future generations be seen as abhorrent or embarrassing or inappropriate in other ways. And I think most people are kind of blind to that, to the bondage of the present, as it were, blind to certain destructive elements of contemporary life. We receive it as given, we participate unthinkingly, and we move on.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's your relationship to younger generations, your curiosity and connection to them, which seems to allow you to somehow wrest yourself out of that to some degree and access slightly ahead of the curve, perhaps, or anticipate a future present, as it were.
Yeah, maybe. I did a lecture in Austria about slow architecture and sort of trying to present the idea that architecture that is not made in one go in a 4-year, you know, design and construction project, but like is a constant process of iteration and repair and maintenance that plays out over like 30, 20 years, whatever, that might be a more ecological and aesthetically rich approach to architecture that like it's not really done on a project by project cycle, but like this sort of ongoing act of care. And someone came up to me after the lecture and I'm like, oh, I like that lecture. You talk like such an old man and yet you seem quite young. And I think I took it as quite a big compliment actually, because I think there's a sort of serenity and a wisdom that I really admire in older people. I think there's immense things that we can learn from the young. And I think we institutionally, chronically fail to learn any of those things by just ignoring young people from very, very, a very young age to a very low age. We just ignore them. They're almost like subhuman. They don't count. But there's also, we can't learn everything from the young. And there are some of the most seductive ideas that I kind of cottoned onto when we were doing the degrowth Oslo Architecture Triennale were much more stereotypically associated with like the patience and serenity of older age. Mm-hmm. And I now live in this community where, so 1960s council estate, we do a lot of gardening. And I never really thought of myself as a gardener, but learning to plant things is now an immense source of just like well-being and like mm-hmm. calm. And I think that's not the youthful side of me pursuing that necessarily.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the Oslo Architecture Triennial was incredibly influential to me actually as a teacher. I remember reading a piece by Smith Mordack, formerly Maria Smith, in the RIBA journal, introducing me to the philosophy of Georges Bataille and this notion of dépense.
Yeah.
And to me, this articulated a feeling that I had. It kind of gave word to it, that this embrace of slowness, of a kind of non-productive expenditure of energy, which is inherently anti-capitalist, was incredibly motivating to me, and I was looking for ways to bring that into an architecture studio.
Yeah.
At the same time, there are inherently complications here that inevitably arise between the way we talk about architecture aspirationally and the way it continues to be practiced. This has come up recently in an interview I did with the curator of the Sharjah Architecture Triennial, Tosin Oshinowo, where again there are these vast discrepancies between the way one talks about potentials in practice and the way one practices themselves.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I think one of my concerns or curiosities about younger practitioners is that increasingly there aren't any. Actually, it seems like a lot of momentum in architectural discourse
is in the discourse.
Is in the discourse. It's in understanding, and rightly so, understanding systems and structures of oppression, of social relationships, of politics and economy, of the flow of materials.
Yeah.
And there is an increasing reluctance to get down in the pit and make something. And so I think as productive as the triennial was for me personally, and I'm saying this as someone who's left practice myself, you are someone who's actually never practiced architecture as it were, I'm just wondering where it leaves the making of space now.
It really annoys me when there's a certain kind of critic who is very sneery about practice, as if like it's cooler or better to be a curator than an architect. And I think that's absolute rubbish. I have like enormous, almost infinite respect for architects. And the reason I'm not in architecture probably is because I couldn't hack it. because it's so hard and it's so slow and so fiddly, and you have to deal with these nightmare clients and nightmare builders, nightmare economic conditions, and you somehow need to make enough money to pay the rent and have enough time to raise your kid or whatever. I see it as this like phenomenally difficult challenge. No wonder there's fewer like burgeoning young practices. Like the conditions in which those people have to practice are harder than they used to be. And I think that does inevitably mean that people are not sort of, you don't have as many young practices setting up, flying off the shelves, making changes as you might like. But I'm very keen to, even though I'm not in practice myself, to use my platform and power to celebrate architects, because I think ultimately they just do incredibly important hard work and often get a bit of a kicking from some snobs in the kind of critical curatorial discourse land that I don't think it's very helpful. I don't think it's very strategic. The Oslo Triennale, which was about, it was trying to understand what a truly sustainable economy would be like and what architecture would be like in that economy. And probably a truly sustainable economy is one that is not growing every year. It's either like leveled out or it's actually shrinking, strategic shrinking of the consumption of resources. And that probably will mean a very different type of architectural practice, where architecture is more of a cultural thing. It's more of like an ongoing cultural project than it is an economic, a sort of speculative endeavor to add value to an economic project. I don't know if, it was sort of quite a sci-fi triennale in a way.
And in fact, the corresponding publication was a collection of science fiction.
Yeah, instead of doing an exhibition catalogue, we made a book of short stories and one kind of cartoon that were all science fiction stories of, in very weird, different ways, trying to sort of test the idea of what a different economy might be like spatially. Some of them were more successful than others, but I think it was a really nice attempt to make a different kind of exhibition catalogue. But De Pons, this idea that Bataille kind of comes up with and then gets seized on by the degrowth movement, I think is hugely rich and is like instructive whether or not you're in architectural practice. It completely reframes how you think of how you spend your time. And I am like a recovering Protestant maybe who has to be productive. Like that's how you get to heaven in the kind of Protestant worldview, is you have to like do loads of work. And even in my spare time, when I'm not like working for an employer, I find myself being productive in some way. Working on the estate community or like making these mobiles or like writing for whoever, sort of obsessed with productivity. And so the idea in degrowth economic theory that actually that's bad and you should deliberately seek to use some of your time on things that do not have a productive outcome. Maybe they have a cultural outcome, but they are not like an investment that will pay dividends economically, seems really important, both for our kind of like well-being and our stress, but also for how we wean ourselves off this growth-based economy that is like destroying the planet. I don't want to blame young architects for like, you know, I totally I couldn't set up a practice today. Like it's crazy. Like I kind of admire anyone who's making a crack at it and doing good work. Because there's also like lots of young practices who are like not very good and like they're producing work that's like derivative or facile or like not particularly thought through or even well designed. And some people are like, yay, celebrate this, young people doing stuff. And I'm like, no, the point about empowering young people is not to just like allow any old crap to enter the world. It's because young people have the power to do really good stuff. And if we're sort of empowering the young people, but like not giving them the tools or providing the kind of ecosystem for them to actually achieve good stuff through that empowerment, then it's not really that meaningful.
That's so interesting that in a way, the role of criticism also seems to be changing a bit, and that to really critique something becomes a lot riskier now. That I really feel like there is a growing atmosphere of self-congratulation or affirmation, mm-hmm. which is necessary to some degree, but it does render more nefarious the genuine critique. Have you encountered that yourself, or do you still see yourself as a critic?
Yeah, I guess I try to use my platform as a critic to encourage great stuff rather than be mean about the bad stuff. And that does run the risk of allowing a sort of slightly cynical culture where like all sorts of kind of crap things just get kind of nodded through and celebrated. But I think the power of a critic is not just to be like critical, like you should also be celebratory. So that's the approach I've taken personally. I do remember I've had conversations with people in the industry about this, and they have said, you know, I will never criticize this architect for whatever, like whatever crap they produce, I will always be positive about them, because I sort of see that as like, I don't know, that they see that as necessary to their own career, like that they have to sort of, that they will succeed more through being a hype person than through making enemies. Mm-hmm. But it does run the risk of a very self-congratulatory culture at times.
Is that a problem for you, or how do you see a way around that?
I don't know if it's a problem for me. Like, I find it very annoying. I guess it's a problem with the PR industry to some extent. And there's the sort of the very, very cozy relationship between PR and certain types of journalism that can lead to like the same stuff just being like celebrated again and again and again, even though like, so maybe what I'm trying to do is hopefully like, I don't know, not just fall into the same trap of like promoting the usual crew, like always dig a bit deeper. Mm-hmm. At Turncoats and now at Open City, whenever we did a public debate, we would always try and find people that no one had ever heard of before to speak. And we were putting people on stage who now are like fairly famous and like have a platform and they've curated this or they've whatever. But at the time, probably most of the people in the room had never heard them before, only knew them maybe because they were friends personally or something. And we're still trying to do that. So like the last one we did about feminist architecture, we had a builder from Wales, non-binary builder from Wales, who gave the most incredible manifesto for how construction sites could be feminist spaces. And it was like a damning critique of construction culture, but also like a very loving appreciation of what's great about being a builder. And then this like literally 100 suggestions for how you could make a construction site a more feminist space. Phenomenal. I don't think anybody in, you know, I'm sure that person, Toby, is like well known in building circles or certain natural building circles, but like no one in the architecture land heard them talk before. And so that's maybe how I approach that kind of insipid self-congratulatory culture is to like not fall into the trap of celebrating the same old characters and always try and find other people to platform.
I'm not really sure like where I'm going with this. I don't feel like it's quite ended though.
What's your big finish?
I'm not sure. It's not my big. I don't think there needs to be a big finish, but I feel like it's unsatisfying to end on this idea of platforming.
Yeah.
I feel like that word somehow, it's become overused and it's dissolved into something less potent than I think we imagine it to be.
Yeah.
Especially as I see younger and younger people assuming the role of the platformer.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That it shifts the onus or responsibility onto some often almost anonymous third party. I mean, it's different in the context of a curator or a, you know, director of an organization like Open City. But I think, you know, kids these days, they want to be platformers too. And somehow there's a relinquishing of, in some way, responsibility, maybe, experimentation, certainly, risk, absolutely, when you become a platformer and not, you know, someone making or producing the work to be platformed.
Yeah, like I blame Hans-Ulrich Obrecht, really, like the idea of the celebrity curator. I think curation should be basically an administration. Like you should be, it should be about spreadsheets. It is about convening and organizing, but like you should never really be in the spotlight, I don't think. And there's so many people out there, young or not, who are quite obsessed with being kind of celebrity, micro celebrities, rather than doing good stuff. And ultimately, I care much more about doing good stuff than having a large Instagram following or you know, any sort of platform. I always see these things as like it should be a means to an end. Like empowering more young people is a means to an end. In the end, being like a richer industry that's got cooler ideas and like institutions that are constantly provoked from within by these younger voices. Empowering black and brown people who've been historically marginalized. Again, it's like, that's good in itself, but it's really, it's a mean to an end. It's like, okay, it's not so, why don't we have a writing community that's more diverse? It's like, and then what happens? And like, what does that community do differently or better or more provocatively than it would have done if it had remained broadly white? And I see the same challenge in everything. Like Open House Festival, the biggest architecture festival in the world, like hundreds and hundreds of places opening their doors for free to people of any background so that those people can like go around number 10 Downing Street or my flat or like number 1 Canada Square, whatever. It's like, so what? Like, is that just a nice day out? Or is that trying to achieve something else? Is that trying to elevate the public understanding of architecture to the point that more people feel confident objecting to a planning application or commissioning an architect themselves? I see all of my work as always having an eye on some other change that ultimately is about trying to make the world better. It's trying to like make a better built environment that could be more sustainable, more community-minded, more democratic. And maybe my frustration with certain actors in the industry is that I don't know if they have got that big picture. I think they maybe are just a little bit stuck on like the success of the project that they're working on and that like how that benefits their career or their profile or their institution or whatever. And maybe have not always got like the theory of change of like how that might have a knock-on effect that is good for the world at large. And that's really why I admire architects so much, because I think of all the kind of industries, they have the patience and the care to see something through that they might put up with all sorts of shit in the process of making a building, but they stick with it because they know at some point that thing will be finished and it will be having a positive effect on a neighborhood or a family or an organization. And that patience and that seriousness is really inspiring. And I think there's a lot that we in the kind of critical curatorial discourse land need to learn from architects.
I think it's this long view that characterizes so much of your work. And I wonder if, to close, we could take a long view on your own career. Where is it going? Does it continue to reside at Open City?
Oh God, I've no idea. Like I've never really had much of a plan. Like I got into the Architecture Review sort of by accident, ended up at the Architecture Foundation because the editorial team imploded and Ellis Woodman had this like great idea that we should go and reboot the AF together. And so I've never not been very good at anticipating what's coming next. I've developed more of a kind of writing platform and this kind of sculpture sub practice that are very interesting and rewarding, but I don't think either of them could be a full-time job. If you, I think they'd lose some of the joy of doing them if it did. In a way, the thing I think I'm most excited about is my community and my family. Like, you know, I don't have any kids, but like, maybe I've spent a bit too much time thinking about work and activism and affecting change in the wider world. And the most exciting thing to do next would be to focus a little bit more on my neighbourhood, my neighbours, and like what we can make here in Greenwich in southeast London. I think that's the next big adventure.
Ben, thank you so much for your time.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me. Big fan, regular listener.
You've been listening to Scaffold. I'm Matthew Blunderfield, and I produce the show. The theme music is composed and performed by Luke Blair. Subscribe to Scaffold on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts, and follow the show on Twitter and Instagram at @scaffold_podcast. If you like the show, spread the word and leave a rating on iTunes while you're at it. Thanks to Finn Harper. Special thanks this week to Ellis Woodman. Thanks, as always, to Scandalin. And thanks to you for listening. I'll see you next time.